thought we'd start the show off like that? Birdland BS. Check it out.
What's up, Birdland BSers? This is Scott with your latest edition, episode 47, coming to you Tuesday, May 29th, 2018. Thank you for joining us. And today we've got a good show for you. Today, the title of our show is aptly named Capital Punishment.
That's right. We're in the ship, baby. We're in the ship.
We are in the ship with the Capitals, and we're in the other word that kind of rhymes with that when it comes to the Orioles. So hence Capital Punishment. We've got a good show for you lined up for you today. As you can see, we're going to talk about the Capitals. We're going to talk about the Orioles. We're going to touch on some of the Ravens news. And then it's Fred's turn to do the 2-minute warning.
That's right. I'm locked and loaded. I'm ready to go.
All right. So guys, you know, Fred, we've been talking about this, and if you guys, you know, haven't been paying attention, then, well, you don't live in Baltimore or DC area or Vegas and pay attention to hockey a lot. The Capitals have advanced to the finals.
Yes, sir.
And we go into the ship.
First time in 20 years, since 98. The Ole Kolzig and Peter Bondra days. Long time ago. Many moons ago.
And, you know, what got us there was that immaculate shutout game by Holtby in game 7.
Back to back shutouts. The guy had never had a shutout in his career in the postseason and puts up two of them back to back when it matters the most.
Well, exactly. I mean, it really came down to it. Those two games, you know, they were one and done in both games.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one of those things that it really shows you that this team has a lot of fire and heart. You know, Holtby held his own in both those games because they were having plenty of shots on goal. You know, for the Lightning, they had 29 shots on goal in that last game, and the Caps only had 23. So
very efficient the Caps were with their shots, for sure.
They were. But that just shows you, you know, Holtby was really holding his own.
Yeah. Speaking of the fire in their eyes, I don't know if you watched the entire game, but did you see Tom Wilson and
you know, I was really I had to watch the replay of that. My son, I love him to death, but I hate him for this moment because I missed it. I had to put him to bed and I missed that moment.
I thought you did. I wasn't sure if you saw that.
Yeah, I missed that moment, but I did see the replay, and it was, you know, a lot of fire in Wilson's eyes. You know, he was not happy about the Kuznetsov shot, and then coming out of the penalty box, and just both of them just looking at each other going, let's go, throw the gloves down and let's go.
But you know the great part about that, and the great part about hockey is, like, if you watch the end of the game when they're, you know, slapping hands and everything, those two guys high five like nothing had freaking happened. You know, that's like the underlying rule of hockey is that, you know, you drop your gloves, you throw your fist, and when it's done, like, you leave it there.
Exactly. You leave it all on the ice.
Yeah. But all, I mean, he had all the reason to get upset. You know, the guy literally ripped Kuznetsov's jersey off his back. I mean, in a dick move, but again, the one thing that they did in game 6 was they were extremely dominant and extremely physical. I mean, they manhandled Tampa Bay game 6. Game 7 was a little bit different. They came out, they weren't really playing super aggressive, and the crazy part about it was some of the bounces that normally do not go the Capitals' way at all ended up going the Caps' way in Game 7, you know, both in their favor when they're trying to score and in the favor of the Caps when Tampa Bay was trying to score. Holtby, he had a couple of dribblers go right between his legs, and somehow he managed to just sandwich it together and keep it from going in the goal.
The one ended up under his left pad, and he just held it there, and everybody's like, where the heck's the puck?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was good. And you talked about it was, you know, it was a different kind of style game. The one thing that was there is there were a lot of hits by the Lightning. Yeah. I think the Lightning, what hurt them in that series, and especially in Game 7, was they were overly aggressive with trying to get the hits. You know, when you look at the hit stat for Game 7, the Lightning had 46 hits to the Capitals' 27.
Which was a complete flip-flop.
Exactly.
Of Game 6.
I think the Lightning hurt themselves.
Yeah.
Because they were a strong team. In my opinion, they still are a strong team. These two teams went to Game 7, so obviously they're strong enough.
Right.
But I thought the Lightning... I'll be honest. I thought the Lightning was going to come out in Game 7 and go, you're not going to, you know, we're going to come back from a shutout.
They kind of got out of their element. You know, they changed their game plan. Look, Tampa Bay is a damn good hockey team.
Oh, absolutely.
And they changed their game plan up completely, I think, because they knew they were getting manhandled and they knew they were getting out physicaled, that they figured in Game 7, we need to change up our game plan. We got manhandled and we got shut out Game 6. Something needs to happen. And look, at that point, to me as a coach, right, you do what got you there. You don't really change up your game plan just based on one bad game. You know what I mean? No, you just come off of winning 3 straight games against the Caps.
Yeah.
Yes, you lose Game 6, which ties the series up. But just because you lose that one game, you don't go and change your entire game plan and your entire, like, for focus of what your team is good at. They're a fast hockey team and they can shoot the puck with the best of them. And they try to change into this almost defensive, like out physical, you know, defensive minded team. And it just didn't work out for them.
Yeah, no, it didn't. You said it perfect. They literally flipped roles between games and it was ridiculous. But as we move on to the finals.
That's right. Game 1 is in the books. Unfortunately, because of the holiday and everything else that's been going on with work and whatnot, we were going to try to do this prior to the series actually starting. Unfortunately, here we are. It's Tuesday evening, and we are on the opposite end of Game 1, and we know the outcome there. What did you see, Game 1?
Game 1, they were outskated.
Yeah,
they could not keep up with the speed of the Knights, and the Knights, it was a big thing going into this series. The Knights are a little bit younger of a team,
right?
And they've got an experienced goalie.
Well, that was to your point there. That was my wife and I. So my wife is just kind of like just now getting into hockey. Like she's kind of picked up on it in the last couple of years. She's got a big thing for Tom Wilson. She likes Tom Wilson. So there you go, Tom. One of the things that I said to her, because she asked like what I thought on the series and what I thought how it would go. And before the game started, I said, this will be a low scoring series, not just a game, a low scoring game. If you tell me any team scores 4 goals or more, they're going to win that game regardless.
Yeah.
And boy, was I wrong.
You know, that's two games in a row that we both have been wrong. We said the last game was going to be, you said it was going to be a real high scoring game. I said it was going to be a low scoring game. And Holtby goes out and puts out a shutout against it 4-0.
Well, that's why I figured, you know, you got Holtby playing at his best. You know, he comes off of back-to-back shutouts. Marc-Andre Fleury is one of the best goaltenders in the league. And he steps up his game to another level.
Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he steps his game up to a whole nother level when it comes to the playoffs. And you know, the Caps haven't had the best success against him in previous years. So I thought, well, there's no way this is going to be a 2-1, maybe 3-2 kind of game at most. But if you tell me a team's going to score 4 goals, that team's winning.
Exactly.
And the Caps lose first game 6-4.
Yeah, no, it was both teams were shooting the puck a ton. In that first game, you know, you had the Knights who had 34 shots on goal. The Capitals had an unnormal, I'll call it, 28 shots on goal, because normally they're at 30. Normally right. they're at 30 right. to 35.
Yeah.
So they were only getting, they only got 28 off.
Again, very efficient with their shots, though.
They were. You know, your shooting percentage is definitely up there. But on that same piece, the power play, they couldn't take advantage of. Each team had one power play.
Yeah, that was another thing I mentioned to my wife. We got into about midway through the second quarter, and I thought, wow, either the refs are letting these guys play, or these teams are really playing clean.
When it comes to the finals, I think you have to let the teams play. There were some hits that were questionable. There were some after whistle.
Basically, the game-winning goal number five for Vegas. I mean, if that wasn't a cross check, I don't know what is. Yeah. Dude literally hit him in the back.
Yeah.
And then shot the puck in, and they did not call it. I mean, that's so critical. You're talking Stanley Cup Finals in a 4-4 game towards the end of the third period, and you either don't see that, which I don't know how you don't see. You're blind if you don't see that. Or you blatantly miss that call and let that call go.
My thing with it, there was way too many missed opportunities on their part. You know, on the Capitals' part.
I agree with that.
And it's in every sport, but, you know, hockey is definitely one where there's plenty of opportunities, plenty of chances, you know. And to say that one thing swings the game one way or another, I don't think that's changing the game. I think they're still going to score. Does it maybe change the little bit of the tempo, potentially? You know, it's big.
That was the third period, at the end of the third period, when the Caps had just tied the game up. And now here comes Vegas back to take the lead again on what should have been a penalty. I don't know. I think that there's, with technology the way it is nowadays, and I'll tell you, hockey is one sport that seems to be able to get their replay judgments done pretty quickly in comparison to some other sports like football. Baseball. They seem to be able to come up with their judgments pretty quickly. That would have been something that if you threw a flag out on the ice or whatever it is that you're going to do to challenge a play, they would have seen in 2 seconds and been like, okay, no goal, to the box, 2 minutes.
I think the hard part is that it's, you know, well, I mean, to your point, you can't challenge penalties in the NFL. And there's a reason for that, because you know why? Because every coach out there would throw the flag for every ticky-tacky little play. You can't do that on penalties and stuff like that. Penalties have to be at the discretion and the judgment of them. And I tell you what, it kind of goes both ways, because there were some hits that the Caps were given the Knights that were a little questionable. You know, that one was probably the most obvious, and it came during a critical moment in the game.
Right.
But I think overall, it's just something that you kind of have to let him play. I like to see him let him play. Yeah, it was a bad moment for that to happen, and it happened. But that doesn't change, you know, the tempo of the game, the fact that there were so many missed opportunities by the Capitals. You know, there was a shot that I think Ovechkin had. He was on the left side, coming up left side, and he had it in his stick, and he went back to shoot, and when he came through, he literally completely missed.
Oh, yeah. There were a few. There were a few.
Several whiffs.
There were a few centering passes. I can remember one that was centered to TJ Oshie, and I mean, he had basically a wide open shot on net and completely whiffed on it. There were a few opportunities for both teams.
And some of it, I tip my hat to the defense, because the defense played a role in some of those, but...
Absolutely. Yeah. But you know, something that we missed on, and I wanted to bring up, and I was thinking about this this last night, because I wanted to get your opinion on it. What was your opinion on the opening ceremonies to this? Like, so I have never watched a Vegas hockey game. This was the first game I'd watched Vegas play, and apparently, like, this is something not out of the ordinary for them. Like, this is like what they do for their home hockey games.
They make it a show. Yeah, I've heard that.
And I get that. I mean, you know, Vegas is kind of the, you know, the show atmosphere. Like, that's kind of their thing. You think it was a little much?
I loved it, to be honest.
Really?
And here's why. Because the NHL is kind of, it kind of sits on the back burner, and somebody is looking to take the thunder of the NFL right now.
Right.
And I think the NHL is doing a pretty daggone good job of it right now.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be the most publicized. And maybe it's because we're coming from a standpoint of the Caps. But at the same time, you know, the Vegas story, it's a movie.
Yeah.
Whether they win or not, it's a movie.
There's definitely a Hollywood script waiting for this whole season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Caps could be said the same way. You know, there could be a potential movie, but the bigger movie story is the Vegas story.
Absolutely.
You know, coming back after tragedy. And I think that's why I like it so much, is because I think that city needed it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot that happened, and there's up until this year, they really didn't have anything like this. Nothing that brought the city together.
Yeah.
And the Knights have just really gone through and in my opinion, really set the tone for any sport team coming to Vegas.
Well, you know, that got me thinking. It got me thinking of when the Raiders come to town.
Yeah.
Of how big of a spectacle that's going to be in Vegas. You know, I will say this, like, hockey's gotten to the point now where it seems to be at its highest peak that I think it's ever been as far as like popularity goes. I think that it's just, it's really, really picking up just to the general public, which, you know, you could talk to somebody about hockey and most people didn't know anybody's name. They couldn't tell you, they couldn't name five hockey players.
Right.
I feel like there's a shift in that. But you talk about the NFL and the popularity of what is the NFL and them kind of needing something to get their face cleaned up a little bit. You know, they've had some negative things going around with the NFL. This Vegas thing might be that antidote that they need to bring some excitement back to the league.
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, when you look at some of the hockey movies, I was actually looking at this today. You know, you look at some of the popular hockey movies, The Miracle, you know, Slapshot,
right?
Goons, you know,
Mighty Ducks,
Mighty Ducks, you know, but think about when all those movies were made.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in the 80s,
80s, 90s.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's, there's nothing that's been in this generation. You know, you got plenty of baseball movies that have come through. You have plenty of NFL movies. You know, you just had the draft. You have Blindside. You got the concussion movie with Will Smith. You know, baseball movies. You've got a whole ton of movies. Moneyball being probably the most recent, most popular movie with baseball.
Right.
There's really not anything that's newer for the NHL. Whether they win or not, I think it's a big thing. The one thing I did think was quite hilarious and screwed up at the same time was during the opening ceremony, Bryce Harper dropping the puck.
Yeah.
For the opening ceremony, the puck drop, and he's in a Knights jersey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's his hometown, right? That's where he was born and raised. I've always kind of like, I've been on the opposite side of most people with that. You know, some people feel like when, you know, you sign a contract with a professional team, like you have to kind of take on and adapt your life to all the local sports of that town. I don't necessarily follow that motive. Like I think that if you grew up a diehard, you know, whatever fan, and that's who you're a fan of, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Not that Bryce Harper grew up a Vegas fan, because obviously Vegas didn't have a team till this year.
No, but I mean, for me, I think more of it is, and I would agree with that. I don't have a real strong opinion on this, really, to be honest, one way or the other. But for me, I think it's, it does show a lot of respect for a city when you go in and you kind of take it on as your own. You know, Adam Jones is a great example here in Baltimore because he took on the Ravens, you know, and him and some of the Oriole players have been known to go to the Ravens games.
Yeah.
Some of the Ravens have been known to show up at Oriole games, you know, so it's a shared interest because you're in a shared interest in a city, but I do get the hometown aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I think it put Bryce Harper in a really tough position. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was kind of funny. You know, he's coming out in the Knights and he's kind of looking at Ovechkin and they kind of like laughed about it for a second,
right,
you know?
Right.
But you know, you can't, I agree with you. You can't necessarily down a guy for doing it, but I do think there does need to be an acceptance. What I think would have been awesome, I don't think he would have ever agreed to it, but I would have loved to have seen him come out in a split Knights Caps jersey.
Yeah, that would have been kind of cool. Yeah, then you would have, you know, wouldn't have known where his allegiance lied. You know what I mean? Because
he could have made a comment later, and that's fine. Yeah, but right. He's representing both cities. I think that would have been cool. Just an extra step. I don't care that he did it. I just thought it was interesting that, you know, you bring him in, you know, you let him do that in that sense.
Well, you you brought up Ovi and him dropping the puck with Ovi sitting there. So he was getting back to the game. He was a guy that I really wanted to see come out in game one and play just as strong as he did through this entire playoffs, because he really has. He's elevated his game to another level. We've been saying that for the past couple of weeks on this podcast. Like, he's really adapted and taken on this leadership role of this team. But it almost seemed to me like he took a back seat in this game a little bit. I mean, he only had two shots on goal in game one. He had a couple of big hits. I think he had like four hits throughout the game, but just didn't see the energy. And, you know, I always chalk game one up to a feel it out type of game because you're, you know, you don't know what a team's game plan is kind of going into it. You don't know if like their game plan is to take you out specifically, especially as the star player.
Oh yeah.
You know, is it there? Have they been watching film and they see that I'm dominating? So are they going to do everything that they can to make sure that I don't beat them? And if that's the case,
double team, hard hits, you know, all that stuff. Yeah.
Right. And if that's the case, we need the others to step up, which I think the others did a great job. I mean, you get four goals against Marc-Andre Fleury, nine times out of 10, I mean, with a good goaltender in your net, you're going to win that game.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, like I said, I just wish that I would have seen the same level of intensity from Ovechkin. But, you know, again, I think everybody else kind of saw what was going on there and stepped up in his not absence, but in his...
I mean, he still spent 19 minutes on the ice, which is greater than he did the last few games. He was averaging about 17 in the last series.
Right.
But, you know, to your point, I think you did have some guys step up. You know, you had a Wilson who stepped up, who had nine, I think it was nine hits.
Yeah.
Only one block, but he also had two shots on goal.
Yeah.
You know, and one of those he made the shot for one of the scores. You know, Nicholas Backstrom kind of stepping up with one of the goals. Again, only having one shot on goal. That was another guy I would have expected to step up a little bit more.
Right.
Orlov on defense, you know, five shots on goal from a defensive player.
Yeah, it's pretty damn good.
You know, that kind of tells you how that game went. Three shots for TJ Oshie. I mean, those are the two guys with the most. And then Carlson also had three. But at the same time, like, You gotta have guys like an Ovechkin, like an Oshie, like Wilson, like a Smith Pelly step up and be shooting a little bit more. And Kuznetsov had three as well, so I forgot to add him in there. But I'm used to Kuznetsov having way more shots on goal.
Yeah,
he's been declining the past few games.
He's more. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like he's a good offensive player, but he's more pass first than he is shoot first at this point in his career. I think once we see Ovechkin kind of graduate to retirement and that kind of thing, you'll see Kuznetsov take more of a, you know, an offensive mind as far as shooting the puck. But he's again Kuznetsov probably one of the best puck handlers in the NHL.
Really, the reason he was on the ice for almost 20 minutes.
Right. He can distribute the puck better than anybody. Him and Backstrom, did you see the behind-the-back pass?
Oh, yeah.
From, I think it was TJ Oshie.
Yeah.
Unreal, man. These guys had some really, really good puck movement between the three of them. Those three guys, Backstrom, Kuznetsov, and Oshie, they're all three guys that can be offensive, they can shoot, but they can also distribute the puck. And I thought the three of them did well, and that's why we were able to end up scoring four against Marc-Andre Fleury.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all three of those guys definitely play a huge role, and if you don't have one, you know, you decrease the likelihood that they'll be able to, you know, kind of continue. You know, one thing I thought was interesting about this whole series, just kind of, you know, bringing it back to Vegas home style for a quick second, was the betting odds on this. So at this point, the betting odds before the game started, I think it was like 2:30 was like the cutoff. I used the Westgate futures odds. Vegas was a 4-6 favorite, which means if you put down a $100 bet, you're going to win a total payout of 166. So you're only winning $66 on that.
Right.
But when it came to the Caps, with the Caps payout on a $100 bet, you were winning 125, and your payout's 225.
So Vegas got it right then.
Yeah, I mean, so far, this was on the series.
Right. This is on the series.
Yeah, this is on the entire series, you know, that Vegas is favored as a 60% favorite. So, I definitely think it's quite interesting.
Yeah.
That game one kind of comes out the way that it did.
Right.
You know, look, if you're looking at it as far as implied odds, it's 60-40. That was what the implied odds were. If you are a better. If you're not a better, it's 4-6, 5-4, that's kind of the common thing that everybody uses. If you ever watch horse racing, that's what they're using, is they're using the fractional odds.
Right.
But you know, the payout there is massive if the Caps do pull this out. So, you know, just kind of throw that out there. They are bigger underdogs. And as this first game hits, I'm sure the betting odds as we get closer to game two will shift to be a little bit closer, probably to 70-30, somewhere around in there. Yeah. You know, just the way that the game was played. But we'll definitely have to see. You know, one thing, we mentioned Fleury a few times. This is his fourth title. He's had four titles. Or, I'm sorry, looking for his fourth title. Holtby is looking for his first.
Right.
So how much does Fleury's experience play a role in this series?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, anytime you have a guy of his caliber talent-wise, and then you give him that level of experience, I mean, it takes some of the nervousness out of it. It takes some of the been there, done that, you know what I mean, kind of mentality. You know, for Holtby, we talked about this before game six. Holtby is a total different goalie when he is relaxed and calm. When he's relaxed and he's calm, it's hard to score on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You give him his first matchup in Stanley Cup final for him, you know, you give him that kind of added pressure. Yeah, it makes him, you know, a little bit tighter. And obviously, you see, you went from back-to-back shutouts and what looked like a comfortable Holtby back in the net to maybe a guy who was questioning himself a little bit last night. And, I mean, he let up 5 goals. So.
You know, one thing I noticed out of both goalies was something that was very, what I feel is very unconventional of both goalies during their good games, is both of them seem to be coming out a little further than I'm used to seeing them come out.
Yeah.
Most of the time, the two of them.
But that's when Holtby's playing his best, I feel like.
Is when his back's literally almost touching the goal all the time.
See, now I'm the opposite. I think when he comes out and when he's aggressive and he's in the front of his of the blue, you know, his blue circle, I feel like he's at his best there because he's trying to poke at the puck. He's trying to get the puck at its high, at its peak, you know, at its highest spot, versus it getting a chance to be deflected in front of the net and having a chance to, you know, change direction.
That's a good point.
Because I mean, that's the thing. Like, if you saw some of the deflection goals last night, his hand-eye coordination is amazing, by the way. Cause to watching this in slow motion is just unreal, but his glove will go up right where it needs to be. And then boom, it gets deflected maybe 4 or 5 feet in front of him. And that changes from a high shoulder side puck where it was going to be to a low, like 5 hole in between the two, you know, skates. Whereas if he gets up in the crease a little bit further, that trajectory isn't as sharp. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And then maybe that hits him in the chest and it keeps it in front of him.
The only thing I say to that is you do have more time to react. And there was one shot in the game yesterday where there was actually one for each goalie where it was literally a deflection. And Fleury had the more impressive of the two. But it was coming over glove side, got deflected, went stick side, and the arm on Fleury just went up, I mean, inches. And it hits the top of the stick above his hand.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Bounces off the post and bounces back out.
Right.
You know, and there was a similar one. It was a stick side that went glove side, but Holtby had it, tipped it off the glove and basically kind of hit it away. But both those type of plays are, to your point, those are impressive plays.
Yeah.
You know, and those are impressive saves where you're having to react. I do agree with you that coming out a little bit for both of these guys, you know, it does give them a little bit broader piece to be able to, you know, to stop it. But I do feel like you have less reaction time, which is what was happening on these goals. They were coming so far out,
yeah.
You know, for both of them. There was a shot on Fleury that, you know, he's all the way on the other side because he was literally out of the crease trying to stop the puck and it got shot over and shot in.
Well, that was my big takeaway from last night was, I didn't think that Holtby played terrible. I just thought Holtby gave up too many rebounds. instead of smothering the puck and keeping the puck close to the chest, there were too many second chances for this team. I don't know. I didn't look at the stats to see how many rebound shots there were and that kind of thing, but it seemed like almost every shot the Vegas Knights took, they had another opportunity to put it elsewhere. And that's how they ended up getting a lot of their goals. I mean, we talked about this when the playoffs started. I said one of the things that the Capitals just need to continue to do is just keep throwing the puck at the net and being down there and wait for the, you know, the ricochets and the bounces and that kind of thing. Eventually, you're going to get one that's going to go in.
Well, the big difference, too, to your point, you know, it was like a basketball game last night when you're looking down in the crease.
Yeah, they got two or three guys down there waiting.
Exactly, and that's why they were so successful, whereas the Caps were, you know, they had three guys back.
Right.
And you got one, maybe two guys in you know, close on the goal. And that's, I think, to your point, that's exactly where it was.
Right.
There, if you, the more guys you have there, the more you can have shots just go in from one or two guys from the outside. And, you know, you're going to be able to slap it back in, or you're going to be able to take the rebound shots and, you know, make them successful every time.
Yep.
So, you know, and we talked about, to kind of go back to Ovi for a second, you know, one of the things that we've kind of hit on is his leadership on this team and where he takes things. Is his leadership of this team and this team in general going to be strong enough to overcome Vegas strong?
I don't know. I mean, that's tough. That's to be determined. Look, if he doesn't make it work this year, I don't think he'll have too many more opportunities at this. I mean, he's getting towards the end of his career. He's definitely on the back nine for sure of his career. So how many more opportunities will this team get? I mean, they're young. Don't get me wrong. They're young. They can still add a few more pieces. They can still compete. But for him, this is probably going to be his best opportunity to win the cup. That's why I said, I really wanted to see him come out game one.
Oh yeah.
And dominate. Come out, set the tone. Game one, like I said, it's kind of a feeler out type game to see how, you know, things are going to play and what your team, you know, your opponent's strategy is. But I would have really liked to seen him come out and set the tone to let them know, hey, I'm the dominant player in this series. You're going to have to deal with
recognize,
me. Yeah. Right. You're going to have to deal with me first and foremost. And I just did not see that out of him.
No, I definitely didn't. I didn't see it as much as I wanted to either. I think it's definitely,
you know, too easy. It's too early to turn in the card and say that, you know, he's done for the series. It's game one. I mean, you know, exactly. That's why I'm trying to, like, not, you know,
don't overreact
him. I'm not trying to overreact or trying to bash him in any kind of way. I just wish I would have seen a little bit more out of him trying to, like I said, set the tone, even if that was being aggressive, big body guy. I mean, you don't want to get hit by Ovechkin. He's a big dude. And if he comes out there and he lays a couple people out, that you know, that gets into people's minds. Just
oh,
like
does.
Tom Wilson does. You know what I mean? He gets in the back of people's minds. Tom Wilson's on that ice, people are looking for him.
Oh, absolutely. And you're watching your back for him too.
Right.
So, yeah, I definitely think he's going to play a pivotal role in this series. You know, just as some of the other players will, but I think to your point, Ovechkin's tone over the next 2 games are going to be the pivotal piece.
They need to win game two. In my opinion, if they really want a shot at winning this series, they've got to win game two. They got to get back to winning on the road. You know, that's kind of what, obviously that's what got them through, Tampa Bay series.
Yeah.
You know, and they ended up winning the Pittsburgh series in Pittsburgh. So they need to win this, take a split from in Vegas, and then hopefully go home, and take the next two.
Yeah, I hope they do. It's going to be, you know, wait and see. I think you know, tomorrow is going to be a big game to see what happens and where this series goes. Like, I think to your point, they have to win game two. It's no ifs, ands, or buts. If you don't win game two, coming back from an 0-2 in a series like this is going to be
against probably this team and against that goalie, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, it's going to be really tough, really tough. I'll tell you what is tough. It's tough to watch our birds.
Yeah. Real, real hard to watch them anymore.
Yeah. This is an Oriole punishment, and it's a punishment for the Caps doing so good. We get to deal with the Orioles doing so bad. It's beyond belief. They're not getting any better. You know, just as a quick rundown, and I was talking to you about this. I pulled some stats on Monday evening. Sunday evening. To look at where did the Orioles rank in everything. Let's look at hitting for a second. The Orioles are sitting in 13th out of 15 teams in the AL. 13 out of 15 in team batting average, 232. They're last in the AL in OPS at 685. Strikeouts, they're second most, 487. Only Texas is ahead of them, and they're leading the majors with 535.
Good Lord.
Yeah, Texas is sucking right now.
As bad as we are with strikeouts, Texas with 535, that's 50 more. Wow.
Yeah. 11th in home runs. Or I'm sorry, 11th in walks with 153. So 11th out of 15 with walks, meaning you're not being patient at the plate.
Not getting on base.
Can you guess who's leading?
The Yankees.
The Yankees, 211. Yeah. And 13th in the AL in runs, 207. Can you guess who's leading?
Yankees.
287. I mean, hitting, these guys are really struggling.
Well, and when you, to put that into simple terms, just real quickly, talking about stats, 11 out of their last 13 games that they've played, they haven't scored more than 3 runs.
It's ridiculous.
In 11 of their last 13. This is the team that's built around offense. Like, that's what this team is known for, is offense. I mean, even hitting, you know, a few home runs here and there, you're going to run into 3 or 4 runs in a game easily.
You need to run into 3 or 4 games.
I mean, yeah, you would think, but this team just, there is nothing positive going on with this team right now at all. In any aspect of, the only silver lining that I found, you know, I was digging deep. I was trying to find some sort of like positivity out of this team. The only thing that I can say, if they win tonight, they're 500 in their last 20 games. As sad as that is, and as bad as that is, but that's actually a positive for this team right now.
That's horrible.
Right. But that's it. That's like the one silver lining I could find. It's awful.
By the way, for a home run hitting team, we're 8th out of 15. With 63, and who's leading again? The Yankees, 83. And the Red Sox are behind them with 76 in the AL. It's ridiculous. It's beyond belief. And, you know, it's not the only spot that's there, you know, but it definitely says something. If you weren't paying attention to the news with the Orioles this week, over the past week, you had the whole issue of Jim Palmer coming out and on live television calling out Chris Davis.
And I had no problem with that.
I didn't either. I have a buddy of mine who did have a problem with it. He's like, you know, that's, you don't air the locker room issues. If you want to say, I'm not seeing any improvement or whatever, but
that's,
you
don't, not a locker room issue though. That's just,
well, what
somebody observing what they observed. I mean, that's the truth of it.
And that's what my argument was you gotta understand where that comment from Jim Palmer stemmed from, and it's from him and Rick Dempsey both looking, and he said it first. Dempsey said he goes back and looks at it, sees it completely. They show it on live television.
Yeah.
Chris Davis swings at the ball and he's looking at the left field foul pole, not the ball.
Yeah, nowhere near the ball.
You know, whether he's not seeing it, whether he's given up, I don't know what it is. And then he comes out and changes his stance for one at bat and then changes his stance right back.
Oh, that was just to be a dick. That's all it was.
But you know what? That shows that you aren't working on it.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
100%.
Well, and I guess the only dirty laundry that was kind of aired about that thing was Palmer's conversation with Scott Coolball. You know, Davis had hyped up all spring training and all offseason.
All this work that he put in.
All this work that he was putting in and all the time that he was spending, you know, on focusing, on really trying to, I mean, he was telling us that he was learning how to lay bunts down, and they weren't going to be able to shift against him anymore because they were going to, you know, he was going to lay the bunt down, and he was really working on going the opposite way and all that stuff, because that's where, you know, a lot of his power came from when he was doing really well. And then Palmer had a conversation with Kubal about it, and Kubal was like, we never worked together. I mean, he never put in any time with me.
I think they said three times over the offseason that they met. Which, you know, the argument comes out of, okay, well, how many times is acceptable? Well, when you're telling me you've been working with your hitting instructor all offseason, I would expect the number to be
that's
more
a daily grind. I'm thinking that's a daily grind, especially with the amount of money you're making and the struggles that you've had.
I'm expecting if you're saying you're meeting with your hitting coach once a week, I'm expecting you're meeting with him on the regular. I'm not expecting three times in the entire offseason.
No,
I'm expecting three times a week,
especially somebody with his kind of struggles. Yeah, and to meet with your hitting instructor. Just to get even a good hitter, just to be a better hitter is normal. This guy should be putting in the work day in and day out until he gets this shit figured out.
Yeah.
He's basically robbing the Orioles blind of $170 million right now.
At this point, it's mental.
Oh, it absolutely. I mean, now granted, he's always been a high strikeout kind of guy, even when he was playing at his best. Oh, he was always been a high strikeout kind of guy.
Yeah. Well, the year before he hit. His season high home runs and Orioles season high home runs the year before, he was terrible.
Yeah.
No, everybody does forget that Chris Davis, you know, we saw a stretch for Chris Davis.
Right.
Where he was okay. You know, in my opinion, you know what Chris Davis is? And it's something got to do with Texas. He's another Josh Hamilton.
What?
He's another head case.
Yeah.
He gets in his own head. He's got all this stuff going on. I do question the Adderall piece. I question if he's still on it. I question if he still has the... I haven't heard anything come out on it, if he still actually has the okay on it from Major League Baseball. But since then, it's been like this big mystery as far as what's going on with him.
Yeah. But, you know, the crappy part about it is we can sit here and harp on Chris Davis all we want.
He's not the only problem.
This team is just so bad, top to bottom. Even Manny Machado's in a mini slump right now, and I told you that this could happen, and this is where we might see. Hopefully he can get out of it, and hopefully he'll be all right. And you know his average is starting to drop a little bit, but this is what I was talking about earlier with striking while the iron's hot and making sure that we get the most that we can for this guy. And one thing, and I haven't talked to you about this, and I didn't bring this up for a reason because I kind of wanted a genuine answer from you and, you know, something off the cuff. Buck kind of has a reputation that follows him from organization to organization. Players love him, but over time, the message becomes stale. And I don't think it's that Buck's a bad manager. I just think that he is probably one of the most unique managers in Major League history in the sense that nobody that I can think of has the success that he has from organization to organization. I mean, they're almost mirror images of each other from what he takes when he first gets there to what he makes them into a very competitive, very good ball club to then falling off the face of the earth and then being released, you know, out of his job. So are we at that point now with Buck? I can't imagine there are too many happy players in that clubhouse right now.
I think I might disagree with you just from hearing I don't want to say the going on, but if you listen to the after hours interviews or the post game interviews that these players are doing, I hear music going, I hear ping pong being played, I hear the pool going. I know these guys need to de stress, but I want to play a clip for you that makes me feel what needs to happen in this clubhouse. And it's a clip from the movie Moneyball.
Okay.
And it's the clip where Brad Pitt's character asks, is losing fun? Funny music playing. Brad hears it and he turns around.
Billy, quick question. Do you expect these guys to produce more?
Or? No, guys.
For the slump.
clubhouse. These guys having fun, joking around. Grab your bat. And everybody shuts up.
Get down. Losing fun? Is losing fun?
No.
What are you having fun for? That's what losing sounds like.
Well, that's, I mean, that's basically to my point exactly. So the team is what? What are they? What's the record? Is it 17 and 37 right now? Or
it's somewhere in there. I'd have to look
they're
it up.
20, they're 20 games below 500.
Oh, yeah.
And you're saying that you're hearing ping pong going on in the background. You're hearing music going on in the background.
When they're at home, yeah. You hear all that stuff.
So where is this? Where's Buck coming in and slamming the hammer down and saying, this is not acceptable, and I'm not going to allow... I mean, at what workplace... I know at my work, I'm not playing and dancing on the tables and playing ping pong and all that kind of stuff. I get it that they got a distress, but these guys are high-paid athletes, and they are not performing to their abilities. We know, we can go right down the list of each one of these players. Is Alex Cobb a 1-7 pitcher? No. Is, you know, Adam Jones a 250 hitter? No. Is... You know, I mean, you could go right down the list. Every single one of these guys, except for the, you know, with the exception of one or two, are severely underperforming from where their standards are. So that's what I mean. Is the message stale? Has Buck kind of lost the power over this team to be able to rein them in when it matters the most?
I think Buck has always, you know, and this kind of goes to your point, Buck has always been the manager that kind of allows the players to police themselves. And at this point, that's not okay.
And I feel like that's kind of what I'm getting to. So
17-37.
Yeah, so they were 20 games below. So that's the way he's managed. The way he's managed has been the same way he's managed throughout his entire career. When he was with the Yankees, when he was with the Diamondbacks, when he was with the Rangers, when he was with the Orioles. It's always kind of had that same mentality. That's why at first a lot of people like playing for this guy because he's more of a player's manager. You know, he won't take any shit, but at the same time, like you said, he doesn't act bigger and bolder than everybody else. He kind of allows the players to be adults and the players to be men and to police themselves. These are all grown adults. But at the end of the day, if you give people too much of a leash, they're going to keep pulling on that leash until that leash stops and until somebody pulls back on that leash. And that's what I think Buck needs to do is Buck needs to say, all right, I've let go of this leash far too long. Let's rein it in. And each one of you needs to have a reality check. What can you do better to help this team? Does that mean coming in an hour earlier for practice, taking an hour extra in BP? Does that mean taking more fly balls in the outfield, taking more ground balls in the infield? Whatever it is that you need to work on, is it an hour before the game? Is it an hour after the game? Whatever it is, you're assigned to do that, and now you need to do that for the betterment of the team. And I don't feel like he's been able to do that, and he hasn't done that yet. And that's where I feel like maybe the message is just stale.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I agree with you. The message is not there for these guys, you know. And I think your leaders at this point are done. Adam Jones is done. Manny Machado is not playing for the Orioles. Manny Machado is playing for himself right now. And if you think otherwise, then you're an idiot, and I'm sorry. You know, I hate to give people a reality check, and I'm sorry if somebody doesn't like what I'm saying. But if you think Manny Machado is coming back next year as an Oriole, you're off your rocker, and you're crazy. Yankees are going to offer him money. Boston is going to offer him money. Who knows who else is going to offer him money? I'm sure there's going to be a few teams.
There's going to be quite a few
in the National League that are going to offer him money. Mm-hmm. He's going to have his team to choose from. You know, I don't think you're going to see, you know, what happened to some other players this past offseason happen to Manny Machado. There's going to, you know, Manny may wait a little bit to see what, you know, how much he can really milk out of these teams and what kind of offers he can be getting. But he's not playing for the Orioles next year at this point. And you know, the fact that we have Davis, who it took up till yesterday to have him sit a game, and you can't afford to have that much money on the bench. You know, I keep hearing everybody in local talk saying, oh, they need to bench Davis. You cannot bench that amount of money. As much as I agree with you, as much as I want to do it, you can't. You can't afford to have that much money sitting on the bench for half the season. A, because he needs to get better, and B, because you just can't afford it. You can't have that happen. A game here, a game there, fine, whatever. But you can't afford it.
Yeah, we're not the Dodgers. We're not the Red Sox. We're not the Yankees. We can't eat a $170 million contract and be okay with it.
Yeah, but you know, to the same token, this team, it's not just one piece. All the pieces are falling apart right now. You send Caleb Joseph down to bring Andrew Susak up. Andrew Susak can't hit worth crap.
Yeah, well, Caleb Joseph wasn't hitting the ball either. I mean,
You know what? He's a veteran. Hold on. He is a veteran in there, and he's in Cisco's ear. Caleb Joseph, when he came up, was not a defensive catcher.
I agree with that. No. I agree with that. I think there was more to the Caleb Joseph getting demoted than his hitting or than his catching. He was the only one that came out in the media and talked about how bad the team is doing and how the team needs to put more effort in and how the team needs to do this and do that. He's the only one that's come out and questioned the team publicly in the media. And then right after that, he gets the demotion. Now, the demotion, you know, like I said, statistically wise, this guy wasn't hitting the ball. He was hitting below 200.
Yeah.
But if your future catcher is Chance Cisco, and he's in his rookie year, what's he going to learn from Andrew Susak?
Exactly. Nothing.
He's going to learn more from Caleb Joseph. So I agree with you.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous, that move. I don't care if he came out and said it or not. At this point, as a fan and as a, you know, as a fan of baseball, I understand that there's some things that need to stay in the locker room. But there needs to be some dirty laundry aired at this point. And I think we saw that with the whole cool ball situation, which then brings up the question of, okay, you know, and that's a completely different topic. We're not even going to get into that. But how much of a role is cool ball and Howie Clark playing, the assistant hitting coach, playing into these guys, you know, and how much is the, you know, we're a home run hitting team playing into the mentality of these guys? Everybody's swinging for the damn fence and everybody can't hit the curveball. Now, all of a sudden, half the team is not able to hit the curveball and is Pedro Serrano. Well, when you got a bunch of teams of Pedro Serranos and everybody knows you're not going to throw the curveball, you're not going to hit the curveball, guess what you're going to get thrown almost every other pitch?
Right.
And you're seeing that. But there's more issues to this team. The pitching. Let's go here for a second. Pitching on this team. We are 14th in the AL in ERA, 5.06. The only team behind us are the Royals at 5.29. We have the most hits given up in the league, 525. We're 13th in runs given up, 286, with 263 of those being earned runs, and that's 14th in the league. 13th in home runs given up in 73, and the worst average for teams hitting against us, meaning teams are hitting against us the best, 282.
Yeah.
At what point is this team doing good? Now, I do put some of this on the hitting because it's a lot different walking out there with a three-run lead and being able to defend it versus going out. And in the first inning, you know, you guys are, especially on the road, putting up a zero and you got nothing to work with.
Right.
It's a little deflating on the road.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get that first strike, and the earlier you can get it, the better. But that plays a little bit of a role. But that doesn't play a role when you're at home and you give up in the first inning a home run. Tonight, unfortunately, Dylan Bundy, happens to him.
Right.
You know, in the game yesterday, it was the third inning, but it's Anthony Rendon with a three-run home run. Who told Cobb to throw Rendon I think it was a 1-2 fastball down the middle? You know, it's just some of this stuff you question, and it kind of comes back to what you're saying. How much of this is Buck? Buck is a situational guy. For those of you that don't remember, Buck is the guy that walked Barry Bonds with the bases loaded. What does that tell you about Buck?
Buck's also the guy that left Zach Britton sitting in the bullpen.
He's situational.
Playoffs.
Yeah. No, he is completely situational. And he doesn't think about how that situation plays a role in the future.
I mean, I'm there. Like I said earlier, I love Buck, and I will forever be grateful for what he's done for this organization in the last 5-6 years that he's been here.
I tip my cap to him and I say, good day, sir.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, something has to change. I don't think it comes from within this clubhouse. I don't think there's anybody in here that you promote internally to his position. But something's got to change, because it's just, at some point, does Dan come in and say, Buck, you need to get a hold of this team?
Dan doesn't care.
I know. And that's the thing. Like that's to my point. Like it's not just in the clubhouse. It's even in the front office. This team, this organization is a mess.
Yeah.
From the top down.
There's way too many. There's too many situations and people involved in a where am I going to be next year moment.
Well, yeah, and they went into that. You know, even, you know, Adam Jones before the year started, you know, was making comments about wanting to play for a World Series contender, and you know, he wants to get a ring and all that stuff. And I'm right there with him. You know, he's in the latter part of his career. He's probably got one more bigger contract left in him. And, you know, if he wants to go chase a ring, go for it. I get that. But that just goes to show where his mindset was going into the year. You got Chris Davis lying about how much work he's putting in. You got Manny playing for Manny. And that's okay, because it's been a productive Manny. But You got Manny playing for Manny and not really taking on, like you said earlier, not really taking on that leadership. In year whatever this is, he came up in 2012. So this is year 6 of Manny Machado. And he's one of the top 3 baseball players in the league. He should be the vocal leader in that clubhouse by now. Forget Adam Jones being there. If it's not him and Adam, 1A, 1B, he should be right there with Adam.
I think you got too many Chiefs and not enough Indians. I think you have.
But that's the problem. You don't have Chiefs, because you don't have anybody stepping up and being that voice of the locker room.
But is that the problem? Is it Jones is trying to step up? Davis is trying to step up? Trumbo is trying to step up? Manny's trying to step up. Scope's probably trying to follow Manny. O'Day's trying to step up. You know, he's not even there. He's hurt right now. But O'Day's trying to step up. You know, you've got all these guys and no one true leader. You have too many Chiefs and not enough Indians. Somebody's got to back off. I would have expected, you know, Adam Jones has been the leader of this team from the get-go. And maybe it was time for him to pass the reign to Manny and say, Manny, you lead us to the promised land. Maybe that did happen. Maybe Adam did back off. Maybe this is a result of that. I don't think it is, but I see there's way too many Chiefs, not enough Indians. This is a veteran-heavy team.
I just don't see anybody holding anybody accountable for anything. You don't see it in their tone. You don't see it in their interactions with each other. You don't hear it in the post game. You don't hear. I'm going to give you a situation. So just the other night, this was either last night or maybe the night before, Jose Altuve, it was subtle, but it got the point across. Lance McCullers was pitching for the Astros the other night, and there was a ball hit down the line. The first baseman either bobbled it. He did something, overthrew it. Something happened. I didn't actually see the play because I saw the end highlights of what happened. And McCullers, you know, shouts out loud, "Oh, damn it," or "Oh, fuck," blah, 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 you know, because his first baseman, you know, made an error or screwed up. So very next play, they get out of the inning. They're walking back to the dugout. McCullers reaches his hand out to high five Jose Altuve as he's coming off the field. As McCullers walking into the dugout, Altuve smacked his glove down and basically ridiculed him. He said, basically, I don't know his words because obviously, you know, you didn't see it, but I can only imagine his words were, "Don't harp on your players for making a mistake. Like, your guy made a mistake. He's also gotten you out of things. He's gotten you out of plays, and he's made plays for you
right.
that necessarily wouldn't be made for you," blah, blah, blah. That's a leader. That's somebody not who gives a shit if the cameras are on me or not. I don't care if it gets talked about in the media or not. I'm going to bark at you, and I'm going to, you know, and he did it, and you could almost see in McCullers' face like, "Oh, shit, you know, I messed up. Yeah, you're right. And you just don't see that with this team from anybody.
No.
And you don't hear about it in the media. And I know Buck is more of a, you know, to the chest kind of guy. He likes to keep things, you know, under wraps and all that stuff. But at some point, something has to change. Somebody needs to take this team by the throat and say, "What are we doing?"
I think it's too late.
No, it is. It's well too late as far as salvaging this year. But what are you going to do? Are you just going to give up on the season and just, you know, not play anymore? At some point, you got to do something. And if that, for me, and we've talked about this in the past couple weeks, it's bring up the guys that are playing. Bring up the young guys. See what you got. If you're really folding on this year, cash in on all the pieces that you can cash in on. Bring up all your young guys. You got a guy in Cedric Mullins, and I know I bring his name up all the time. He's hitting .500 in the last 2 weeks down in AA.
Yeah.
He just won Eastern League Player of the Week.
Yeah.
Why is he not up on this roster?
At this point, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And
he's not better than Gentry? He's not better than Rickard?
He's better than Rickard. I don't know if he's better than Gentry yet.
You're too high on Gentry. You are way too high on Gentry. Gentry, I get it. Like, you know, he needs time, whatever. He sucks. He's not any good. He's versatile. Yeah, okay. He's a decent outfielder. Okay, he's a terrible hitter.
Look, is he a number one on somebody else's team?
He's not even a number four on most other teams.
He's your backup guy. He's your backup outfielder on other teams. He's on a team that has no identity in left field. You need a guy in the only identity you have in the outfield on a consistent basis is Adam Jones.
Yeah.
Period.
Right, but you got Cedric Mullins sitting in AA
ranking. No, absolutely. But why is Joey Rickard up here?
I know, and I get that. But I'd rather see Joey Rickard up here than, like, you know, Mark Trumbo getting, you know, reps in the outfield or Anthony Santander who
here's what I tell you would be the perfect scenario is somehow, some way, you pull a Yankees with David Justice move and you pay somebody to take him. That's what we think of him right now. I will pay somebody to take him. I will take part of his salary. You have to agree to a portion of it, not all of it.
Who I'm not going to make you
take Davis. Oh. Davis has got to go.
Well, that's why that goes back to what I was saying before. If we got a package deal where we could give up, you know, to a team that can absorb that salary. Like a Dodger,
but they're not gonna absorb that salary. We have to take whoever takes him. We will be taking the brunt of the salary, and they will be taking a smaller. We will basically be paying someone to take him. That's what we think of. That's what happened with David Justice with the Yankees when he went to the A's. They took on part of his salary. It was actually addressed in the movie Moneyball because it's that scene where Brad Pitt is right there. And I cannot think of the guy's name, but this guy that's playing David Justice in the batting cage, and he literally makes that statement. The Yankees are paying us to have you face them. That's what they think of you. That's what we think of Davis right now. He could go somewhere else. Give him to New York. Give him to Boston.
They're not going to take him.
They're not going to take him. But the point is some, you need somebody to take it, because what the perfect scenario is,
you find me that player and I take that deal all day long. I don't
I'll take him for nothing.
Yeah, no, I get it. But
I'll
like,
take him for nothing.
Who's going to take that salary on, whether it's half of it, three quarters of it? This guy isn't worth $2 million a year, yet alone
$30 million
a year.
No, but perfect scenario.
Doesn't belong to be in the majors right now.
Trey Mancini is your first baseman. Mark Trumbo is your DH. Cedric Mullins is your left fielder. Gentry is your left. I'm sorry. Cedric Mullins is your right fielder. Gentry is your left fielder, because Mullins of the two, I think, probably has the better arm. And Jones is in center. Now, what you can then do is, if you needed to, you move Jones over to left, or, and you could probably switch Gentry over to right. I really don't like that move, but then put Mullins in center. But I think there's that move out there that you have to. You've
still got
Austin
Hayes down there as well. I mean, he's not having the greatest year right now, but he's another guy that, you know, I'd like to see him up here getting some experience at the major league level. I think, you know, at some point it's, you know, you got to.
Yeah, it would do him good to be up here for a little bit. But yeah, there's just way too much stuff going on.
Man.
Speaking of
I haven't talked about the Orioles in a while, and this is why. Like, I get so fucking frustrated and heated up with this team. Like, I like, my thoughts are going a million mile an hour in my head that I can't even, like, get it all out and make sense of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so, so frustrating.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. You know, when it comes to our other birds of Baltimore, the Ravens.
They give me a little bit more peace.
For right now, I hope it stays that way. Right. But, you know, we mentioned last week that we had, you know, we had OTAs start for the Ravens. This week, there's been, you know, quite a bit going on with the Ravens, you know, just in kind of general media speaking, you know, terms. I think one of the biggest things to kind of come out of this past week, and you and I are talking about it, Joe Flacco actually comes out and he's asked the question by a local reporter about the whole Lamar Jackson thing. And I thought it was interesting. We're going to play here for a second. We're going to play the clip of Joe discussing that and what, you know, what his words on this were. But he was very kind of cool about it in saying, like, basically, you guys are idiots and blew this out of proportion.
Which is what I said the entire freaking time.
Without actually saying it.
I made an instant reaction for you YouTubers out there. Go watch it.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And where I'm going to start this clip off is, you know, he's kind of finishing talking about one of the receivers. But take a listen to what Joe had to say when he was asked the question here.
How he gets his releases and how he does those things, and I think we're definitely making strides towards it.
Joe, it's the first time we've had to ask you about, had a chance to ask you about Lamar. How are things going? And was too much made about the initial non-conversation or whatever?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at it. I think if you're you guys, then no, too much wasn't made, because I'm sure you got a lot of attention for it. You know, it is what it is. I think it's unfortunate that that's what happens. You know, like, everybody just wants to talk about, and they want to act like I'm holding some grudge, and that's not how it is. I mean, I think you guys have been around me for a long time, and you know the way I am. And, you know, we welcome Lamar here with open arms, and that's the same for me. And at the same time, my approach doesn't change. You know, I want to go win football games this year, and we got a lot of new guys that I have to get ready to play and help us win those games. So. That's the reality of it.
Is it your job to help them or the coach?
Basically, what I heard there was exactly what I've been saying for the past couple of weeks, is I'm not a guy that goes above and beyond. I'm here today. All is well. You guys made something out of freaking nothing. And let's move on with our lives.
Yeah, he definitely was. He had a smirk on his face for the entire first half of that
statement. He knew it was coming. A good old Jerry Coleman from 105.7 to do that.
Leave it up to Jerry Coleman. They all love Jerry Coleman out there, but they hate him at the same time. I think he comes out. He makes the reaction, you know, finally puts it on the table and says, look, I welcome with open arms, but I got a job ahead of me. You know, and that's to focus on these other receivers, bring them up to speed. You know, I think he in turn is saying, you know, if I've got to bring him up to speed too, it's happening. But yeah, we've got a lot of other players that I have a direct impact with that I need to get up to speed.
And, you know, the one thing that I'd kind of heard from some people that have seen just the couple of practices that they've had so far in OTAs and you know, minicamp, Flacco's head and heels above these two other quarterbacks, Lamar and RG3, as far as throwing the football and as far as having the handle of this offense. Lamar, as exciting as a player as he is, he's got a long way to go. I know a lot of people in Baltimore are super excited about having this guy, and I'm one of them. I'm excited for it. I'm excited for the future to see a totally different offense and what that's going to mean for the Ravens. But that's not going to happen overnight. And if I'm putting my money on anybody to make a playoff run for the Ravens this year, it's Joe Flacco. It's not Lamar Jackson. Now, granted, they've also been working on some packages and some plays and everything already to kind of get him acclimated, to get him in the mix and that kind of thing, and to get the offense adjusted to him. But everybody take a chill pill. Everybody relax. Again, Joe Flacco is your starting quarterback, and I think you're going to see a motivated Joe this year. I think that we might see Joe have his best statistical year.
I think he's got to come out with a vengeance. He's got to have something to prove.
He's got a hell of a lot of weapons this year. A lot of new weapons, a lot of exciting weapons. You know, some reports that we've seen in some of these articles already are comparing Michael Crabtree to the likes of Steve Smith and Anquan Boldin. You know, two guys that have been great veteran presence, wide receivers, possession type guys. And
they were pivotal.
They were pivotal in Flacco's success and this team's success. So now you fill that void that they didn't have last year. You know, and again, you got a couple other wide receivers that they added to the group. You get a healthy Kenneth Dixon back from injury to add to the running game. You know, you have a mixture of him and Alex Collins in the backfield, which we didn't see last year. You got two young, good tight ends in the draft. You get a healthy offensive line back, some pressure behind Joe Flacco. Another year of Flacco in this offense, there's a lot of check marks that are pointing to a good season, in my opinion, for Flacco and the Ravens.
There definitely is. I mean, you mentioned Kenneth Dixon. One of the things I saw was he needs to knock off a little bit of rust. Still, they're saying he may need to lose a few more pounds, which I'm sure is going to happen after a knee injury. You're not able to do a lot, but they're saying that he was showing, in their words, some shiftiness. Which is usually, that's a good verbiage to hear.
Yeah.
when you're talking about a running back, a guy who's able to be shifty and be open, or be strong in the open field. So I definitely think that's a thing there. You know, you mentioned the whole Crabtree to Anquan and Smith. I think that was an interesting comparison. Just you and I were talking about it pre-show, mm-hmm. in that, you know, he's a little bit different type of receiver. But I think what the reference really is a guy that's a little bit more in the latter part of his career that can be a strong threat. Nobody can doubt and can deny Anquan Boldin and Steve Smith were strong threats
Ravens. Add Derek Mason to that group, too. I mean, yeah. This has just been kind of a historical thing that the Ravens have always done, is bring in that veteran presence, that veteran possession-type wide receiver. And Flacco has always seemed to do well with them.
I mean, if you're adding these guys to the threat, you've got two tight ends that you've added to the mix. Yeah. You know, and not only that means with Michael Crabtree, if these two tight ends, you know, pan out to what we all really hope and see them potentially being, the backfield, it's going to open up.
Yeah,
because these guys are going to take the shots across the middle.
That's what I'm saying. This offense is not going to be one-dimensional anymore. I mean, you've got the threat of the Lamar Jackson package and whatever the hell that's going to mean and the excitement behind that, which is completely unknown to the Ravens. It's completely unknown to the league. The league doesn't have tape on that, right? Because no. This is all new. You add a dual set of tight ends that this team did not have last year. You know, guys that can get down the field, guys that can actually hang on and catch the football. four or five new wide receivers with the draft picks and everything we have. Again, a healthy offensive line, man. This team's just going to be, bearing injury, that, you know, fearful of what the hell is going to happen in OTAs and mini camps, and hopefully everybody comes out of this healthy. But I'm excited to see what this offense can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely both excited to see the offense. My one question for you is really the big question mark, I think, for most people this year, the bigger question mark is really the defense. You know, you've got Terrell Suggs, who's, you know, what, 37 this year. Many people are saying the Ravens, they don't see the Ravens giving, especially DaCosta, giving him Suggs a contract extension, after this year.
No matter where he goes, whether he stays here or goes elsewhere, he's going to be playing a series of one-year contracts until he's done.
Yeah. And the question is at what point? You know, is it one more year? Is it two more years?
Right.
How much does he have left in the tank? The other big question, and it's a question I would pose to you as well. Is it time? You know, Jimmy Smith for a long time has been the Ravens' number one corner. Is it time to kind of put him on that back burner and say, here you go, Marlon, for Marlon Humphrey?
There's a lot of question marks surrounding that still. You know, Jimmy has to come back and prove that he's healthy and that the Achilles isn't going to be a problem. You know, when you're talking the cornerback position and the shiftiness of what a cornerback needs to do, you need to be able to break and move with a wide receiver. You're not anticipating moves, you're reacting to moves, it puts a lot of stress on the Achilles. So to come back, you know, as a top tier cornerback in this league, which he was before the injury, is going to be a tall task from Jimmy. You've also got Tavon Young coming back from, you know, what was a season ending injury. He had a good, promising rookie year. So you've got some pieces that are there, but you still have some question marks as to how they're going to play. There's no doubt that Marlon Humphrey outplayed, I think, everybody's expectations year one.
Absolutely.
I think Ozzie and the genius that he is saw something in this guy that a lot of other draft experts didn't see, because not very many people had him rated as a top 15 overall pick in last year's draft. But something told Ozzie that he was worth that pick, and we all kind of scratched our heads at it. We all kind of, here we go again with Ozzie, blah, 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 picking an Alabama defensive guy. But giving the way the cards unfolded last year with Jimmy going down and Tavon Young going down in the preseason,
yeah,
it was a damn good pick. And he really stepped up, and he ended up being one of the top rookie cornerbacks last year production-wise. So I don't think I'm ready to supersede Marlon Humphrey into that number one spot just yet. But if we get into week three, week four, and we see that Jimmy has slowed down a bit or is struggling to, you know, keep up with some of the right number ones, I don't hesitate to move Marlon Humphrey into that number one, because in this division alone, that's AJ Green, Antonio Brown, and now Jarvis Landry.
Yeah.
All in this division alone, that, you know, if you put one-on-one coverage with top corner and top wide receiver, that you're going to expect Jimmy Smith to come off an Achilles injury to cover.
Yeah, no, it's going to be difficult to do.
Very, for anybody. Very difficult.
So, well, I don't know about you. I think it might be that time.
Oh, yeah.
It's time for the 2 minute warning.
I'm ready for this week. Locked and loaded.
All right, Fred. It is time for your 2 minute warning. And your 2 minute warning starts now.
Seattle Seahawks. They signed veteran wide receiver Brandon Marshall to a 1 year deal today.
Interesting move.
We'll see if this guy's got anything left, especially in a wide receiver core out there that's they kind of spread the ball around. So we'll see. Kansas City offensive guard Laurent Duvernay-Tardif Tardif is now Dr. DeVarney Tardif after reportedly receiving his doctorate from Montreal's McGill University. So I wonder if they're actually going to put a doctor on the back of his jersey. It'd be interesting to see. Steelers running back Le'Veon Bell released a new rap single called Target. Pretty much sums up the picture of how he feels he's valued in Pittsburgh. If you have not listened to that, take a listen. Mets superstar pitcher Noah Syndergaard, he's headed to the disabled list with a strained index finger. Thanks for that, fantasy gods. My fantasy team's already doing bad enough.
Everybody's fantasy team is killed this year.
Indian setup man Andrew Miller and former Oriole had an MRI done on his left knee. Could be headed to the DL, possible Brock or Britton destination there in Cleveland. We'll see what happens there. It's take four in the Cavalier versus Golden State NBA Finals. LeBron is the greatest of all time. Don't at me, bitches, but he is. Greatest of all time, and I've seen Jordan play. So, in a more sadder news, former Maryland basketball guard Cliff Tucker passed away yesterday at the age of 29 after a van crashed and left him and two other passengers dead. So, bad news. Sorry to add that in the 5-minute or 30-second, 2-minute warning, whatever it is. Football Power Index released their latest Super Bowl odds. As of now, they have it as a rematch of last season's Patriots and Eagles Super Bowl. The Ravens sitting at 15 behind the Jaguars. Got it all in there. Man, that was bad. I shouldn't have thrown that.
Way to just bring the depressing mood even back even more.
It was a weird, you know, tidbit to throw in the 2-minute warning, but whatever. Is what it is.
That was a bad thing. I thought we were gonna go out on a high and you just went.
Yeah, it was not the brightest thing to do.
That's all right. It was good. It was interesting news. Sad news, but interesting news nonetheless. Well, I think we had a good show this week. Make sure that you like us on Facebook. Like us on Twitter at BirdlandBS. Check out our YouTube channel. That's where we're live on YouTube tonight. We'll be, kind of floating back and forth every once in a while between YouTube Live and Facebook Live.
Make sure you drop some comments, hit like on the YouTube page. That gets us noticed a little bit more. And plus, we want to interact with you guys, man. And that's what helps us kind of gauge what we're going to talk about on a week-to-week basis. So if you guys got questions or things you want to hear us talk about, please leave that below the video.
Yeah, absolutely. Check us out on all of our social media pages. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. Check us out on all those. Like us, share us, bring your friends, have a beer, sit back, and talk some sports with us. For Birdland BS, I'm Scott.
I'm Fred.
See ya.
See you guys.